Welcome to the LRIS Q&A podcast. This podcast features questions on public safety, labor, and employment issues submitted to us via our website, www.lris.com. Questions are answered by LRIS Director and noted labor attorney, Will Aitchison. LRIS and Will Aitchison do not provide any legal advice. Listeners to this podcast and visitors to the LRIS website should consult with their own lawyer for legal advice. LRIS is not a law firm, and our employees are not acting as your attorney. The information contained in this podcast and on LRIS.com is general legal information and should not be construed as legal advice to be applied to any specific factual situation. Well, here's our first question. We have a firefighter who was told at a weekly meeting that he would have to get a swine flu vaccination that would be provided at a clinic the following week. He drove to and from the clinic to receive the vaccination and in the course of driving was involved in a motor vehicle accident. Will his injuries be covered by the workers' compensation system?
At the outset, I want to say that workers' compensation laws vary fairly significantly from state to state. And in some places, public safety employees are not even covered by general workers' compensation laws. Instead, they're covered by police and fire pension systems. So what I'm going to give you here is a very, very general description of the principles you might expect to see applied in a situation like this. And let's start with the general principle, and then we'll talk about the exception. The general principle is that injuries suffered while commuting, going to work or from work to home, are not considered to be covered by workers' compensation laws. This is known as, in workers' compensation parlance, as the going and coming rule. And the idea is that work starts when the employee is at the workplace. It doesn't start when the employee is leaving home, driving to the workplace or driving home. Well, now let's talk about the exception, because over the years we've seen many, many cases where public safety employees involved in accidents suffered while commuting have had their injuries covered by a workers' compensation system. Where do we get the exceptions? Well, the first place we get an exception is if the employee is commuting to a specific event where the employee would be covered by what you can think of as an overtime minimum payment. And by overtime minimum payment, a thing, for example, like where a police officer attending court during her off-duty time is entitled a minimum compensation of 3 or 4 hours at the overtime rate, no matter how long the overtime appearance or the court appearance actually lasts. You can have overtime minimums that are court overtime minimums, like the one I just described. Sometimes they can be callback overtime minimums, where the employee gets whatever the minimum amount of compensation might be. Usually you'd expect to see 3 hours at the overtime rate for an off-duty callback. We've seen a lot of courts hold that where the employee is covered by a overtime minimum, that one of the purposes of the overtime minimum is to compensate employees for that commute time, and that the result is that injuries suffered while commuting are in fact on-duty injuries that are compensable. And I'll give you a classic example. This is a case that I actually handled. It goes back many years in Oregon. It was decided by the Oregon Court of Appeals. It's called Pounds versus City of Portland. Here, this is a police officer who's working under a labor agreement that had a 4-hour overtime minimum. The officer was driving while off duty to a court appearance and was involved in an intersection collision that took the officer's life. When the city denied the officer's widow's request for workers' compensation benefits, pension benefits in this case, the matter ended up in the Oregon Court of Appeals. And the Court of Appeals said, look, because of the presence of that overtime minimum, because of the duty-related function to which this employee was going, that's a work-related injury. and as a result, it was held to be compensable under the city's pension system. There are cases from courts all over the country that say essentially the same thing, particularly where the public safety employee is commuting in an employer's vehicle, and particularly where that vehicle is a marked vehicle and/or the employee is commuting in uniform. In those types of cases, of course, you can easily see how the employer gets more benefit out of the commute than would otherwise be the case, something that courts really latch onto and find to be very important. Now, let's talk about the swine flu vaccine, because this is actually a case that happened, and happened in 2012 in New York. And it involved a firefighter that was going to a clinic to obtain a swine flu vaccine while off duty and was awarded workers' compensation benefits. And the firefighter's employer, which was the Scipio, New York Volunteer Fire District, ended up challenging the award of workers' compensation benefits. And the court in this case, and this is the appellate division of New York Supreme Court, ended up finding there to be substantial evidence that this was an on-duty injury. And let me just read to you a little bit of the court's analysis. I'll only read a couple of sentences here. This won't go on to give you a feel. The court said, the record demonstrates that the fire district, at the very least, strongly encouraged EMTs to receive the swine flu vaccination and made arrangements for them to receive the vaccination at no cost. In fact, the firefighter testified that but for the directive from the district, she had no intention of otherwise receiving the vaccine. Under these circumstances, we find that the Workers' Compensation Board could reasonably conclude that the firefighter's injuries were sustained pursuant to her participation in a program to maintain the performance of her duties and thus were compensable under the workers' compensation system. Now, obviously, this is going to vary a bit from state to state, and it'll vary depending upon not just the wording of your workers' compensation statute, but also the history of litigation over the going and coming rule in your state. But we do see this, I think now, fairly well-established exception to the going and coming rule for public safety employees.
The next question is, there is a zipper clause in our contract that reads, this agreement is the sole agreement between the parties. All other agreements, written or oral, are hereby nullified. Does this language erase all past practices so that management can make changes in work rules?
We get this question a lot. Zipper clauses are very common features of collective bargaining agreements or memoranda of understanding. Typically, they appear at the end of the contract. They may be called zipper clause. They may be called a complete agreement clause. Sometimes they're even called an integration clause. And they usually say something to the effect of, this agreement is it. This agreement is the entire agreement between the parties and supersedes any prior agreements that the parties have reached. Zipper clauses have a very legitimate purpose. The design is to encourage the parties to include in their contract all agreements that they have reached concerning wages, hours, and working conditions, so-called mandatory subjects of bargaining. The question is whether or not a zipper clause does more than define what the agreement is about, but also wipes out past practices that may have gone on for years prior to the signing of the contract. And to answer that question, we have to take a step back and look at some basic past practice principles. And the most important principle is that the duty to bargain over wages, hours, and working conditions is thought to be continuing in nature. In other words, an employer can't make a change in past practices that concern mandatory subjects of bargaining, so an hours of work issue or a working condition issue, without first bargaining with the union, unless the union has waived the right to bargain over that change. And that's where zipper clauses become important, is employers will point to zipper clauses, much as they'll point to a management rights clause and say, this is a waiver of the right to bargain over changes. What a zipper clause does, as the argument goes, is to eliminate all past practices. We start over when we sign the contract on a blank slate. That argument has not met with virtually any success, to the best of our knowledge. The National Labor Relations Board has rejected the argument. We know of many state labor boards that have also said exactly the same thing. Why? Well, the reason that zipper clauses are thought not to be effective waivers is actually rooted in general contract law, everyday contract law that you'd see applied to a real estate contract or a purchase of a car contract, whatever it might be. And that basic contract law provides that, or states that, waivers to be effective have to be specific and they have to be clearly articulated. Specific in the sense that they have to be specific to a particular topic. A general waiver, as they're sometimes called, is thought not to be an effective way of waiving somebody's rights. What does clearly articulated mean? It means that the waiver has to say what it applies to, and by implication, what it does not apply to. So let's take an example, and let's look at this waiver clause that's referenced in the question. The example that we can use is an employer that wants to change the starting time of a work shift. Let's say the collective bargaining agreement says nothing whatsoever about whether the employer has the right to make changes in the starting times of work shifts. It's just simply silent on the issue. How will an employer's argument that a zipper clause, a complete agreement clause, constitutes a waiver of the union's right to bargain over changes in the starting times of work shifts, how will that argument fare? And we predict not well. And the reasons are that a zipper clause is neither specific nor clearly articulated. We would predict that what a state labor board would say or a court would say would be, you know how to waive a union's right to bargain over changes in the starting times of work shift could be phrased in a contract? It could be phrased as in language that would say, the employer has the right to make changes in the starting times of work shifts. That would be specific and that would be clearly articulated. A zipper clause, on the other hand, that simply says, this is it, this is the complete agreement between the parties, that sort of clause is neither specific nor clearly articulated. Thus, it is not a waiver, and thus, it does not successfully wipe out past practices. The moral of the story here is if an employer wants to change past practices in an area, a state labor board or a court will, in all likelihood, look at the employer and say, the place to raise this is in bargaining. It's not in a legal proceeding.
That wraps up this edition of the LRIS Q&A podcast. As always, we hope you found it entertaining and informative. Remember, the contents of this podcast should not be construed as legal advice. Please consult your own attorney for legal advice on any specific situation.